Have you seen 2001? It's pretty good. Stanley Kubrick film, famous director, came out in 1968, famous movie. Probably you've seen it, or you've seen bits of it, or you know something about it. It's kind of famous for being extremely cerebral, boring, hard to get through, and often incomprehensible. In fact, if there's one comment that I think I hear over and over again whenever this movie comes up, is that people have no idea what the hell's going on in the film. And it's famous for people leaving the theater or, you know, turning off the DVD or whatever, changing the channel, having lots of questions. And Kubrick is that kind of director. I mean, he makes movies where there's a story and, you know, interesting things happen, but he doesn't do exposition. He doesn't have scenes where characters turn to the audience and explain things that everybody in the scene already knows, because that's not storytelling. It's the opposite of storytelling. So I look at 2001 and I talk to people about it and I think, you know, there are things in this movie that we're supposed to wonder about. There are things in this movie with no easy answer, but there are other things that I think should be somewhat obvious, or if not obvious, the kind of thing that you can figure out if you think about it. So we start in the film millions of years ago, at the dawn of man, I think is the title. We're meant to understand dawn of man obviously means that before this point in the movie, there were no human beings. There were just, you know, clever monkeys, let's call them. A bunch of clever monkeys all over the Serengeti Plain. And when we see them, we see different tribes, we watch them live. There's no dialogue in the opening of 2001, so right out of the gate, the audience is challenged. You're not going to watch a movie that's got bright lights and loud explosions and people falling in love and telling jokes. We spend like 20 minutes with the monkeys, and we watch them live their lives and fight over mates, and there's some drama between some of the tribes, and maybe we understand that some of them have personality, and like we can tell this monkey from that monkey. And after this drama between the different tribes and the things they fight about has been playing out for a little while, suddenly there's a dawn one morning, and there is a black object just sitting there. We don't know how long it's been there. Maybe it's been there the entire time and we just, you know, the camera didn't show it to us, but I think we're meant to understand that it just arrived. Aliens showed up. That's one thing we obviously understand about the monolith, made by aliens. Aliens showed up, dropped this monolith, and then fucked off. We never meet any aliens in the movie. So the monkeys, all the monkeys have different reactions. That many of these different tribes of monkeys all see the monolith. And in fact, of course, the monolith is arguably the first thing, the last thing, the thing everyone talks about when they're like, what is 2001 about? What the hell is the black monolith? Well, I don't think we're supposed to not know. I think Kubrick thought, yeah, if you watch the movie, the answer is in there. You just have to be paying attention. I think there are other things where he felt like, oh yeah, that's ambiguous. You've got to have to think about it for a little while and talk about it. But I don't think the monolith is one of those things. So the monkeys get together and they have different reactions to this new thing. It's obviously made. It's nothing like anything they see. It's not like a rock. It's not like another monkey. It's not something to kill or eat or mate with. And some of them get angry at this strange alien presence, this invasive thing in their universe, and they start throwing things at it. But some of the monkeys are able to conquer their terror with curiosity. And one of the monkeys is able to conquer his terror and walk up to the monolith and touch it. And he's not zapped into oblivion, nothing bad happens to him, and so his brothers from his tribe, the other monkeys in that tribe, all come up and touch the thing. And then we find out when nighttime comes and they sleep, and the next morning they wake up, and those monkeys that overcame their fear are smarter. They develop weapons. What are we meant to take away from this? What is that monolith? Well, I think it's clear it is an uplift device. It is something the aliens put down on purpose to kind of, you know, test the monkeys, which of these primitive, proto-social, proto-intelligent creatures can conquer their fear? In which tribe is curiosity stronger than fear? And whichever that is, the monolith rewards. It actually makes them smarter. It gives them the spark of intelligence, self-awareness, and they are the ones. In other words, aliens came down to Earth. This is what Kubrick and the author Arthur C. Clarke are proposing, and took clever monkeys and turned them into smart monkeys, which is to say, humans. They're saying that we here now owe a debt to some alien race somewhere. It's a science fictional idea. It's a proposition. It's in 2001. Humans didn't get to where we are on our own. We had help from aliens. And that scene, that sequence rather, ends with what's called, you know, by many people, the most famous jump cut in the history of cinema. A jump cut being just a quick edit. No wipe, no fade, no nothing. Just one panel, one frame. You're looking at one scene, and the next frame, you're looking at another. No fade out. No other kind of transition. And it's interesting, that jump cut, because there's stuff happening there. Like, in 1/24th of a second, right? The film runs at 24 frames per second. So 1/24th of a second, we jump 2 million years into the future, to the year 2001. And it happens when a monkey triumphantly takes this bone, like it's like a femur or something, which he has used, right? What happens when man makes tools, right? The first thing he does is he subjugates other apes. He uses a bone to crush the head of his enemies. A very violent reaction. So the aliens who created the monolith they're not benevolent. They don't care that we're good monkeys. They only care that we're smart monkeys. They're absent. They dropped the monolith. They fucked off. They made us smart. They don't care what we do with that intelligence. These are just the conclusions you make if you watch the movie and think about it. So a smart monkey takes this weapon and triumphantly hurls it into the air. The camera slowly pans up. It's in slow motion as the thing. And just as it reaches the apex of its flight, jump cut. 2 million years in the future, 2001, and we see an object in orbit around the Earth. And what's mentioned in the screenplay, but never spoken on screen, is that it's an orbiting nuclear weapon. It's a bomb. So it goes from one weapon to another weapon. Well, we never find out it's a bomb. It's never spoken because probably Kubrick couldn't find a way to get that information to the audience without making it the kind of obvious that he hates. So now we're in space and we get to meet the first character in the game, We get to meet the first character in the movie, Hayward Floyd, who is an important dude, and he's on his way to the moon. He's in space. The next time we see humans go from being smart monkeys to being in space. Watch that flight, the Pan Am flight to the moon, and watch what Hayward Floyd and the other people on that ship have to do in order to exist in space. A normal plane flight, but it has many unusual elements to it. And each of those elements is telling us something about Kubrick's point, the director, Stanley Kubrick's idea. What is the central idea of the film? It's right there in that scene. First, we see Dr. Floyd eating lunch. It's the in-flight meal. And it is astronaut food. It's the kind of food that anybody in 1968 would have seen and looked at and said, oh, that's astronaut food. It's like pasty stuff. It's all mush. It doesn't look like airline food from now, which looks like normal, like sandwiches and, you know, steak or whatever, depending on your flight, but looks like obvious food. This is just all different colors of mush because that's what works in zero gravity. Can't have normal food in zero gravity. Watch the stewardess as she's walking around. She has to wear Velcro booties because there's no gravity. So she has to have something on her feet that holds her to the ground. That's a very interesting, realistic, plausible, science fictional explanation for how you would walk, get around on a ship in zero gravity. And indeed, it's how we actually do it. Not necessarily Velcro booties, but Velcro all over the walls, handholds everywhere so that people can get around on the space shuttle and space station, etc. And then finally, the most amusing part of that segment is Floyd on the can, reading the instructions on how to use a zero-gravity toilet. Well, we really do have zero-gravity toilets. Astronauts have to learn how to use these special zero-gravity toilets that are actually really complex because they have to do everything with suction because there's no gravity. So all of these elements, the food, walking around, going to the bathroom, are all interesting. So Kubrick is like, he's like a magician. He's doing a trick. He's distracting us with one thing over here happening. Woo, look over here. Look at all these interesting, amusing things that would be true if you were on a plane flight to the moon. And at the same time, he's sneaking in a point that we don't necessarily notice unless we think about it. He's saying, in space, in the year 2001, mankind is an infant. On Earth, he is the master of his domain. He builds the nuclear bombs that fly overhead. He has conquered the Earth. He is the master of the Earth, but in space, he doesn't belong. It's not his natural environment. He is being born anew into a new environment, and he has to learn to eat again. He's eating baby food. That's the point of the food that Hayward Floyd is eating, is that it looks like baby food. He has to learn how to walk again. That's why the stewardess is so unsteady as she moves around at zero gravity. Yes, very realistic, but it also makes a point. You have to learn to walk again, and the ultimate insult, he has to learn to shit again. The most basic human function, even that, he has to learn all this stuff all over again. Because space is not our natural environment. The only way we can survive in it is through the use of all these tools that we've developed and adapted. So that's the theme that we're going to revisit for 2001. It's going to become important later on. We get to the moon, and there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff you can watch. It's not, I don't think, necessarily critical to the plot. And we find the second monolith. It has a different purpose than the first monolith. That somebody tells him it was deliberately buried 2 million years ago, which is when dawn of man, the first monolith, is planted on the Earth, and the second monolith is buried under the dirt on the moon. Why? Because it's just a signal to the aliens. The aliens have shit to do. They are not here. They are not watching us. They don't care if we're good or bad. But once we get spaceflight and get to the moon, we're going to discover this buried thing. We're going to dig it up. And just like the monkey touched the monolith, what are the humans going to do? Keep in mind, the aliens don't even know we're humans. They don't know what we turned into. The aliens want to know, do the smart monkeys now, 2 million years later, are they still curious? Will they still walk up to it and touch? Or will they seal it off, take pictures of it, analyze it? And of course, the astronauts do walk up to it and touch it, and it sends a signal to the third and final monolith in orbit around Jupiter, which is another huge cut. We instantly go from that powerful radio signal directed to Jupiter. Now we are at Jupiter on the ship built to go there, the Discovery. And that's where, you know, the real story starts. Everything up to that point is prologue, establishing the themes, mankind is an infant reliant on its tools in order to survive in space, and setting up the story, what is the monolith, why are they there? This mission, we find out, is so secret that the crew are broken up into three different groups, and each of them was given a different brief. There's the three scientists who were briefed in secret on their own. They know about the monolith. They know what happened. They're put into cryosleep even before they launch, which they've mentioned as being super unusual. Then there's Dave Bowman and Frank Poole, who are the guys that run the ship. They have no idea what the fuck is going on. No one explained anything to them. And the third group is Hal, the Hal 9000 computer. He's the only one that knows everything. He knows about the monolith. He knows about the three guys in hypersleep. We know this because later on, there's a video where a guy says, look, your mission was known only by the three scientists and the Hal 9000 computer. So the good news is that had everything gone according to plan, eventually Dave Bowman and Frank Poole would have found out what was happening. But just until we get to Jupiter, we want to make sure that you guys don't, you know, freak out, so we're not going to tell you. But Hal knows. Roger Ebert, when he was doing one of his top 10 movie villains thing, this was back, I think, in the 80s, he put Hal pretty near the top of the list, maybe the top of the list. And he explained that in 1968, when the movie came out, everybody still thought that computers were going to save the world. They were this amazing new technology that was going to free people from, you know, whatever. As Roger Ebert put it, it was an extremely terrifying moment. One of the scariest moments he'd ever seen in a film, when he realized that everyone on this ship, Dave Bowman, Frank Poole, the three scientists in cryosleep, were all dependent on Hal for everything. And Hal was not on their side. That's why he thinks of Hal as being one of the all-time great movie villains. But let's look at what happens. Dave and Frank are just there, effectively, babysitting Hal. Hal runs the entire ship. Hal monitors the life signs of the three scientists. Dave and Frank talk to Hal. They interact with him. And in every way, Hal seems to have a personality. A reporter asks Dave Bowman, does Hal have real emotions? And Dave's response is, well, it seems like he does. And that's the Turing test. If a computer can fool you into thinking that it's a person, then let's just call it a person. What other test do we need? So we think that Hal's a person. And if we listen to Hal's dialogue, we learn some important things. Hal describes himself as being, for all intents and purposes, foolproof or perfect. I don't remember what the exact phrase is. If a human said that, we would think, wow, that guy's pretty full of himself. Hal has pride. He has hubris. Hal has human emotions, as far as we know. And then something interesting happens. Maybe there's some tension between Hal and the two guys on the ship. They don't seem to treat him like one of the crew. You know, they play chess with him, but where Hal says, that was fun. I enjoyed that. Frank is like, yeah, I guess you win. These guys obviously don't treat Hal like an equal. So there's a point in the movie, and it's the turning point. It's where everything starts to go wrong, where Hal makes a mistake. That's what I think happens. I think Hal makes a mistake. He predicts the failure of the AE-35 antenna, but it's not going to fail. Dave and Frank, one of them goes out and grabs the antenna CPU and brings it in. They test it, and they're like, well, I'll be damned if I can find anything wrong with it. And Hal's just as puzzled as they are. I watched the movie again recently, and I was struck by something. And that is, Hal asks Dave, before this happens, he says, This mission seems really weird to me. Does it make any sense that they would put the three scientists in cryo-freeze before the start of the mission? And as he's kind of running down kind of all the weird things about the mission, as though he doesn't know about them, Dave says, you're working on your crew psychology report. And Hal, abashed, an emotion, Hal somewhat like embarrassed, says, yeah, I'm sorry, I have to. It's my job. So if we understand that Dave's right, and he is, Hal is working up his crew psychology report. Why did he use that as an opportunity to grill Dave on how weird the mission is when Hal knows what the mission is? See, that's why I think Hal makes a mistake, because he was given all the information. Dave and Frank were specifically kept in the dark, and Hal was now put into a position where he had to pretend. He had to pretend he didn't know what was going on. He had to talk to Dave like he didn't know what was going on in order to sell the idea that, oh, everything's fine and, you know. And it's interesting that, put in that situation, That's Hal's solution is, well, I guess Hal thinks to himself, I need to pretend like I don't know what's going on, even though he does. That's why there's that conversation with Hal and Dave. And I think that's why Hal makes a mistake, because he's operating outside his normal design parameters. Like, he wasn't meant for this stuff. He wasn't meant to lie and deceive Frank and Dave. But regardless, I do believe that Hal just made a simple error when he predicted the failure of the AE-35 antenna. I don't think that was part of a conspiracy. I don't think it was part of a plan. I think he just screwed up. And as I was preparing this blog post and I was thinking about the idea, I was like, wow, you know, Hal screws up. He screws up in the most harmless way possible. He predicts something's going to fail when it won't, right? In other words, if Hal's wrong, what happens? Nothing. Everything keeps working fine. Everybody's happy. In fact, that's Hal's suggestion. He's like, well, look, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Let's test it let's just let it fail. How do Frank and Dave react to that? They immediately decide we need to shut Hal off. If that antenna doesn't fail, if it works, that means Hal was wrong. The entire ship is in Hal's hands. We can't have a malfunctioning computer running our ship. What if Hal were a person? What if it was a person that made a mistake? What would Hal and Dave do? They'd be like, well, you screwed up. Don't do it again. But, it happens. Nobody's perfect, right? Nobody's perfect. If he were a human, nobody's perfect. But he's not human. They expect him to be perfect. So as I was thinking about this, I was like, wow, I really feel as though Hal's kind of like, they even say, we need to shut him off. We need to kill Hal. We need to kill Hal because he might not be perfect. Wow, holy crap. If you were a person and you were trapped on a ship with people and you knew... you hear them talking, saying, well, we're going to have to kill this schmuck if we find out he's made a single harmless mistake. You might start to think that you had to fight for your own survival. And that is when the movie really digs in. Because now we're talking about the final battle between man and his tools. That's what 2001 is about. Who's going to run the universe? Man? Or the tools man has created to replace man? And I mean, when I say replace man, look at things from Hal's point of view. Look at the ship and the mission from Hal's point of view. Hal's smarter than all of them. Hal is nearly perfect. Can't say that about Dave and Frank. Can't say that about any person. Hal, the crew relies on Hal for food, water, the artificial gravity, light, everything. They are completely dependent on Hal for everything, and Hal needs nothing from them. Natural for Hal to think, I can complete this mission on my own. I don't need these guys. And they're planning to kill me because I might not be perfect. Suddenly, I had a lot of sympathy for Hal and not a lot of sympathy for Dave and Frank. So maybe Hal goes insane. Maybe it's a measured response to Dave and Frank's reaction to the possibility that Hal might have made a harmless mistake. Doesn't matter either way. Hal kills Frank Poole. And now we have Dave Bowman and Hal and their epic titanic struggle, which is famous, has famous dialogue that people quote endlessly. And I wonder how many of them quote it without really understanding the import of what's going on. Dave, after having tried to recover Frank's body, has to get back into the ship. And Hal has no fear of Dave whatsoever because Dave's just a human being. And there's no way for Dave to get back in the ship until Dave says, listen, I'm going to brave the vacuum of space to do it. That blows Hal's mind. No way a human could do that. But Dave is going to prove that humans are more than just smart monkeys on Earth. They can survive even in space. Survive and thrive. In other words, Dave is going to leave the pod without his helmet on. Like a baby being born into a new world, he is going to go into space and he's going to make it. He's going to survive. He's going to close the airlock in time. Even though it's only a couple of seconds, that's all it takes. And now that's the symbol. That's the moment where we know Dave's going to make it. Not because he conquered Hal. He hasn't done that yet. He conquered space. Hal is the creature perfectly adapted for space because he was built by humans to be so. He is our ultimate tool. Dave is saying when he jumps out of the airlock, when the bolts explode and he's thrust into the airless void, he's saying, man is adaptable enough. We can do it on our own. We don't need computers or tools. So he ultimately turns off Hal. We know how that story ends. We hear Hal singing and we see the video. And then we get the most mind-bending and trippy, what the hell was that about, part of the movie. But even that, I think if we just pay attention to everything, if we just remember all the things that had happened before, it's relatively sensible. Obviously, it's this incredible visual sequence. Well, what is that meant to be? There's a monolith at Jupiter. It's huge. It's bigger than either of the other two. It's a gateway. And Dave goes into it by himself. There's no more Hal. The ship is dead. The three scientists have been killed. He goes through this gateway, and that light show is the director's way of saying he is leaving this set of dimensions and going into another one. He's going to visit the aliens. They want to see him. That's what the third monolith is for. It's a gateway to their set of dimensions, their universe, where time and space don't work the way they do here. That's what those visuals are meant to show us. They're meant to show us that space is weird and it's deformed and does strange things. And then we see Dave in his spacesuit exploring this weird environment. It's like a Victorian bedroom. It's like a zoo is what it is. And Dave is the animal on display. And he sees himself as an old man while he is simultaneously an old man remembering being the young person looking at him. What does that mean? That means time is out of joint here. Young Dave and old Dave exist simultaneously. There's no difference between them here. That's what the gateway is. Now Dave is with the aliens. They're watching him, and they're interested in him. And at the end of the movie, for whatever reason, we never find out why, Dave is reborn as the Star Child. That's what people call it. There's no name for it in the film. But the Star Child is the last gift of the aliens to humanity. They're saying, congratulations, you made it. And just as we lifted you up 2 million years ago, we're going to now give you the tools you need to be perfectly adapted for space. So you'll be able to go on and conquer the galaxy, the universe, whatever you want. That's what these aliens apparently do. It's mysterious and it's thought-provoking, and many people get upset at that challenge because that's not why they go to the movies. But I feel as though there are plenty of movies that just hand it all to you, that just tell you everything you need to know, people falling in love, action, adventure, really wild things, leave nothing to the imagination and nothing to talk about afterwards. Why can't we have a couple of movies that are thought-provoking and don't hand you all the answers and make you think about it? I present a logical argument for many of these things, but there are other points of view. There are other famous points of view regarding this movie. One of the things I think we see from Kubrick, and if there's a point to 2001, there's a lot of optimism in 2001, obviously, because Kubrick is saying at the end of the movie, man makes it, not just beats Hal, but gets the final reward from these aliens and gets to go on and become a perfectly adapted space organism, whatever that means. But there's another point, part of Kubrick's ongoing theme in his films. Kubrick was obsessed with the meaning in existence and life. And in 2001, he's saying, there is meaning. There is meaning to life, but it's the monolith. It's alien. It is ultimately unknowable. Don't try to figure it out. Don't bother. You won't get it. It's so alien, it belongs to another set of dimensions. So it's kind of a good news, bad news thing. Yes, there is some greater meaning to all of this, but we can never know it. It is ultimately an enigma. Later on, by the time we got to movies like Full Metal Jacket, Kubrick couldn't even go that far. He said, there is no meaning to anything. There's no meaning even to narrative, even to the idea of filmic narrative. Give up. You get halfway through Full Metal Jacket, and all of a sudden the story stops, and a new story starts in a completely different place, and a completely different plot. You got a character that's got a peace sign on one side of his helmet, and Born to Kill on the other side. Right? Nothing but contradictions. Nothing makes sense. Don't bother trying to figure it out. No meaning. So he starts off, you know, Paths of Glory. There is meaning. Maybe. Men can find it. Then there is meaning. Don't bother trying to figure it out. You never will. And eventually Kubrick isn't even able to go that far. He says, screw it. So that's, you know, I think that 2001 is not only a great film, I think it's a lot of fun to watch because there's all this cool stuff going on inside it, and you just need to think about it for a little while. Watch it again. Talk to your friends about it. It's okay to have movies that make us think.